are making history today.
Woo!
Making history today.
We're making history today.
Woo!
Woo!
Hooray!
Woo! Welcome aboard
the
very first postseason edition of the Purple Dinosaur Podcast. Do you feel like what?
We really should have really come at that a little bit harder, you know?
Should we try it again?
Should really just be like, woo, you guys, seriously.
Should we take it again?
Should we do it again? Okay, ready?
Okay, ready? Three, two, one. Woo, you guys, seriously.
Woo, you guys.
Seriously. Why does anybody ever listen to this podcast?
I don't know. Why they give us 280 characters on Twitter?
I have no idea. I have absolutely no idea. Among the dumbest and most unseen developments of this week was this stupid podcast account getting the double Twitter character limit. What a terrible website.
Yep.
Idiots. So anyway, hey, I'm Tyler Mon.
And I'm Anthony Masterson.
And this is the 118th episode of the Purple Dinosaur Podcast.
Wow.
And the very first in which the Colorado Rockies are headed to the Major League Baseball postseason. How does it feel?
Drink it in.
Drinking? You're already drinking? It's 10 o'clock in the morning there.
I mean, listen, I've been drinking for a lot the last 2 weeks. I will say it was it was worth it though. But
well,
I'm
yeah,
back.
First
I'm,
things
I'm,
first.
I am back stateside.
First things first. How was Mexico?
It was great. Everyone's like, oh,
congratulations.
Did you...
Also, yeah. First podcast with Anthony Masterson, married man.
This is true. It's the that's the ring on the table here.
We don't know that. This is an audio format. That could be anything.
No,
that could be it. We were both trying to think of some snarky line to come up with next,
but
it didn't work.
It's not.
No, but it's not though. So Mexico, tell us.
We spent so much time and energy, getting ready for the wedding that we got there on Monday afternoon, went to bed at like 9:30 and slept till noon the next day.
Nice.
And then the rest of the week was pretty much spent just like wandering around, and basically I was underwater for most of like the entire trip, whether
okay.
it be the ocean, the
literal
pool,
or figurative,
jacuzzi tub, or like just my own sweat because it's still super hot.
I saw
there,
your
human.
Four chest hairs way more than I ever need to see them ever again on Twitter.
And you're going to see them a lot more.
You're just going to start posing shirtless.
I think so. I think I have to now.
That's your new brand.
Yeah.
Your brand is just shirtless pictures on Twitter.
And everybody who's seen them, who has known me for a long time, says, like, you have never looked more like a Goomba in your entire life.
Except for your lack of chest hair.
Well, yeah, that's also true. But I'm hoping that
you're like a hairless chihuahua.
Yeah, since I married into the Greek culture, I can just kind of
you'll get
I can earn it, you know.
By osmosis, you'll just get more chest.
Yeah, I mean that's how it works, right?
I think so. I think it's how genetics go.
Yeah.
No, but yeah. So
we spent the whole week not doing anything at all, and it was awesome. So
that's the whole point, man.
Yep.
Those are the best vacations.
Yes.
Well, awesome. Well, congratulations.
Thank
welcome.
You.
Welcome back. The Colorado Rockies, very good while you were gone.
Yeah,
not so
I
good
noticed.
Since you've returned.
Yeah.
Although you just returned yesterday.
Yes.
But you and I last recorded an episode of this here podcast on September 21st, and we said Colorado Rockies have 10 games left. They need to go 6-4, 7-3, 8-2. And they went 5-5. They still made the playoffs.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'll take it. They finished 87-75 on the year. Had a shot at 89 wins. I mean, had a shot at 90 over that 10-game
yeah,
stretch.
Definitely had a shot at 162.
True. They could have at one point won 162 games. And people forget this, but they started off 2-0 in their pursuit of 162-0. They only
People
had 160
that.
To go. People
yeah.
forget this.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, they did enough. They did enough. They got enough help. The Milwaukee Brewers and the St. Louis Cardinals fell off. The Brewers doing so thanks to the Cardinals. The Brewers on Saturday led 6-0 in a game they needed to win to stay alive in the wild card race. And they lost 7-6.
Yeah.
Which was terrific. And the thing is, had the Brewers won that game, the Brewers won again yesterday, and the Rockies lost both of their games. So there is a chance, and obviously it doesn't at all
Who
factor
cares
the
now,
same way.
But...
there's a chance they could have been playing a game 163 ahead of a game 164, basically. But they're not. And yours, mine, and our Colorado Rockies are headed to the postseason for the first time in the Purple Dinosaur podcast era, which is obviously the most important thing for this playoff berth. And but the first time since 2009, the Rockies are headed to the postseason. Here's what we got coming up on the show today, and then we're going to dive in.
Got a really big show.
Really big show. This may actually be the most heavily produced and most content-packed, hashtag content, episode of the PDP ever in the entire history of this show. And we had an episode to preview the season this year in which we had three guests on. You know how many people we got on today? Like 1,000. Coming up here in a little bit, John Gray, yours, mine, and our ace of the Colorado Rockies, will join the show. Talk to John, and we'll set up that interview in a little while, because talk to John on Friday before all this stuff was clinched. I wanted to get his thoughts going into the weekend, what it would mean for him if the Rockies clinched, if they were able to get through to Arizona coming up on Wednesday for the National League wildcard game. We'll hear from John. He will get the start in that game. We will also hear from one member of the Colorado Rockies bullpen, at times maligned and at times very good this year for the Colorado Rockies, and that is the left-hander Mike Dunn. Mike Dunn will join the show. Mike Dunn in July and August posted ERAs of 1.04 and 2.61. Struggled a little bit in September, but Mike Dunn, fantastic through the stretch when they needed him to be. He was awful in May and June, but we'll forget about that. We'll hear from him. We will hear a little bit from Bud Black, a little bit from Charlie Blackman, a little bit from Kyle Freeland, and we will also rewind the clock back to last August, 2016, when the Colorado Rockies were still hanging around the playoff race, and we had one Nolan Sandblaster Arenado on the show, because I think the juxtaposition of that interview and where we were as a group of observers watching this team, and where Nolan was on the inside of that clubhouse, listening to that now in 2017 is really, really interesting, because a lot of the conversation was, you guys are close, you're right there. And Nolan was, yeah, and that's great, but we don't want to be close, we want to be there. And now they're there. And you've heard from Nolan all this week, you've seen Nolan all this week. So we're going to rewind and we'll hear from Nolan. And in addition, we will check in with Mike Farron behind enemy lines. He is the pre- and post-game host and longtime friend of the PDP, pre- and post-game host of the Arizona Diamondbacks. We'll check in with Mike from Phoenix on what to expect coming up on Wednesday. But just that's how things stack up. Your thoughts, your initial thoughts. Rockies going to the playoffs.
I found out naturally by a pool. I was following along on my phone. The hotel Wi-Fi was able to give me access like game day, and so I was like watching it, just going all the way down through and seeing the comeback, and like kind of like, oh, going back, it's 6-0 Brewers, oh, that sucks, more margaritas please. And then I kept watching, I was like, oh, it's 6-2, oh, it's 6-4, oh, it's 6-6, oh, it's 7-6, and then I said, more margaritas please. And then they actually got the out with, of all people, Juan Nicasio closing the door.
Juan Nicasio.
Of all people.
You know what's funny?
Of course, that had to be, right?
And we said on an episode, because I searched on Twitter, I thought we tweeted it, but we said on an episode at one point, Juan Nicasio is totally going to factor into how the Rockies do or do not make the playoffs, right? And I'm pretty positive that Juan Nicasio was the reason. It was only Juan Nicasio. It certainly wasn't the Cardinals' offense. It was just Juan Nicasio.
I mean...
But really, though, it was Juan Nicasio. What?
Of all damn people, Juan Nicasio got the Rockies to the playoffs.
Of the most random former Rockies.
Yeah.
And there are a handful of random former Rockies who have factored into these last few weeks. Charlie Culberson was on the field yesterday at Dodger Stadium. Juan Nicasio. All these weirdos. They faced Yolish Chacin. They faced Jordan Lyles down the stretch. Very weird.
Yeah. But hey, you know what? Who cares? The Rockies are actually in the playoffs.
The
after all the hemming and hawing that we have done all damn season on Twitter, on this podcast, people leaving the Rockies for dead in May and in June and July and August and September.
And unwittingly putting themselves on Brian Kilpatrick's enemies list.
Yeah. Oh, that was fun watching that go down on Saturday night or Friday night, whatever the hell it was.
Pretty great.
Yeah, after all that, the Rockies spent every single day of the 2017 season in a playoff spot.
They certainly did.
Most of any team this year, 181 days in a playoff spot. The Nationals were second with 179.
And how many days were there in the season this year?
181.
Oh, okay. So it was every single day.
From when the Rockies, from the Rockies' first game to the Rockies' last game, they were in a playoff spot for every day.
And remember, people forget this, they started 2-0 in their pursuit of 162-0.
And to be fair, that's kind of like, I feel like the fact that we finished with 87 wins is, you know, kind of a disappointment, but.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
if
they
were
undefeated.
If that's the end goal every year, you know, like.
For 181st of the season, they were undefeated, and, yeah. You know, whatever. To each his own.
No, I think before the season started, I think we both said, I think I said this team has 85 wins in them, give or take a couple,
yep.
You know, and so they got 87. I feel like that's right about where we thought this team was all year long. And it helps that the National League wasn't strong this year. That's fine. But, you know, you're only as good as the rest of the league you play in. You know,
right.
The NL West now has three teams into the playoffs, like we all thought the entire season it was going to be. And here,
yeah.
I mean, here we are, man. It's hard to explain the feeling that it kind of went through you when they finally did clinch, because it was such a weird time. You didn't have that feeling of the final out. They get the strikeout, they clinch, and they all mob the field. It was like, oh, they found out. They clinched a wild card berth 20 minutes before they had to go face Clayton Kershaw.
Yeah.
You know, it's,
yeah.
So you didn't get that one lone feeling of euphoria,
right?
For them, you didn't get that one signature moment. They got their champagne bath after the game had ended and whatever. But you know, it's been a while, man. It's been 8 years.
Yeah, exactly. And that's you would have loved to have seen them clinch it on their own volition. It would have been great if, you know, the Brewers lost on Friday and the Rockies won on Friday. That would have been great because the Brewers would have been done first, etc. Didn't happen that way. That's fine. But this also. Is this the first time in franchise history that they've clinched a playoff spot before the last day of the regular season? I think in 95 they had clinched the playoff spot, but they didn't know whether or not they were the wild card or the division winner because they needed the Giants to lose. They needed somebody to lose in 95, and they ended up with a wild card. I think they were still in the division race until the end that year. But 07, day of the season,
I think,
game 163.
No, I think that was they needed to win that game to end the year because the Astros were also 76-68, a game behind.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And that was that's right. The Dodgers won the division that year, and the Rockies were in it until the last day. The Dodgers finished 78-66. The Rockies finished a game behind, but the Rockies did only finish one game ahead of the Astros, so they had to win. They were hoping the Dodgers would lose because then he could get some help and maybe plan for a division title. But 2009, I can't remember what the clinching was in 2009, but I feel like that was also on the last day of the year. 07 obviously was.
Yeah, well, I think in 09, they at least finished four games ahead of the next team. So it wouldn't have been on the last, in the last series, not the last day, I don't think.
Okay. The Rockies, by the way, had the second best record in the National League in 2009, which I did not remember. But they, third best. Never mind.
Best.
Philadelphia was a game better. That was an impressive playoff field. That was four playoff teams of 92 to 95 wins in 09. Nonetheless, they do it. They do it on a day in which they get help from somebody else. You get a chance to rest some guys. They didn't have to throw Tyler Anderson yesterday. Kyle Freeland goes out, starts off a bullpen game. It was an ugly, ugly baseball game. They used 36 combined players yesterday, I'm pretty sure I heard. And it took approximately 7.5 hours. But, you know, they're going to the playoffs, man. Like, this is what we've been saying. And I was talking about this with a couple guys in the press box yesterday. Yes, we as Rockies Twitter are being very petty and we're being very vengeful, but at the same time we get a little victory lap here.
Yes.
Because for the last 4 years since we started this podcast, this is what we've been telling people. 2017 opens up a window of contention that's going to last for several years because this team is bringing up a very, very talented group of players. And there are people still out there who want to dump all over it. I was very excited to own Woody Page on Twitter yesterday, who tried to claim that the Rockies only have 10 drafted and developed players on their roster right now, which is wrong. They have 12, and they've also accounted for the second highest WAR total among drafted and developed players on teams headed to the playoffs. But obviously, it's difficult to do research when, you know, you now have slipped to
from Colorado
whatever
Springs
he does these days.
Yeah.
I don't even know if they have the internet there. So the point is, this is not BS. We haven't been lying to you for the last 4 years. This is what the plan always was for this team.
It's not an accident.
And it's worked.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's not an accident. 2007, I think you could even make the argument that was a good team. But that was a team that, you know, they had to go on the greatest run in baseball history in order to make the playoffs.
Yeah.
So you could make a lightning in a bottle accident kind of argument for that team. 2009, that team was very good. 2010, that team deserved so much better. This is the first time that the Rockies have had a development plan in the system. They have had a plan with free agency. They've had a plan on the international market. And not only have they had all those plans, they've stuck with those plans, which is something that they could not do under Dan O'Dowd because he changed his mind like a puppy with somebody who just dumped a bucket full of tennis balls in front of him. Every 5 seconds, he changed his mind on what the plan was going to be. That's not this. This has been the plan under Jeff Breidich since Breidich was running the farm system and since he took over as GM. And it worked.
I mean, the power arms. The power arms were the guys that Breidich really always wanted to acquire within the system, whether it was through drafts, through shrewd trades. He got Herman Marquez, who I know struggled down the stretch, but Herman Marquez is one of those guys who pitched one of the better rookie seasons the Rockies have ever seen. John Gray, of course. Antonio Senzatella did really well when moved to a bullpen role. Jeff Hoppin struggled late, but he's got potential as well. These guys contributed all year this year. Kyle Freeland was a great fit for the Rockies and pitched even better than that. Getting all these guys rounded up, this was the plan. It's so weird to think that people imagine this just being like a fluke season because it's not. You don't be in a playoff spot for every single day throughout an entire season and then make the playoffs because of a fluke. The Rockies in 07 were a good team, but like you said, they had to go on the best run in history. That was as fluky as it gets. I'm not saying they didn't deserve it. I'm saying that is pretty much as fluky as humanly possible to get to a playoff spot winning 13 to last 14 games and having to win every single one of them to make the playoffs and then getting an extra game have to play on top of that. So this team was maybe a year ahead because of all of their young starters that they had, but you cannot say that this is surprising to anybody in that Rockies front office right now.
Right. No, and that's what is most rewarding for the organization, for the guys who've been there for so long, for these players that have all come up together. For Bud Black, this is Bud Black's first season. We'll hear from him in a little bit, but we talked over the last couple of weeks. Bud Black has had teams fail spectacularly in stretch runs. This team did not do that. Could they have played better down the stretch? Absolutely. They could have played better down the stretch. But the fact of the matter is you're getting good starting pitching. You're getting pretty effective bullpen work, and the guys you have needed to come along offensively are coming along offensively in Carlos Gonzalez and Trevor Story. And I spent some time, actually, as random as this is, talking to longtime PDP Twitter follower and mother of Trevor Story, Teddy Story, the other day prior to the game on Friday at Coors Field. She and Trevor's dad showed up, and Trevor went up, gave him a big hug, and I was like, well, I recognize her from Twitter, and I'm going to have to go say hi. But one of the things that she said was it's so cool to see all of these guys who have grown up together in the system now all doing this at the major league level, because those guys have believed and known that this was possible for so long, and now all of that is justified. This isn't an accident. I think that's a perfect way to put it. The way you put it, this is not an accident. This is what the Rockies have been designing and planning for several years. And the fact of the matter is it has never been unfair to hold the Rockies' feet to the fire for failed plans in the past. That has never been unfair.
No.
But to
they,
do
they've
that,
earned that, yeah.
Right. And they very much earned it. And they very much earned it with the public persona that they trotted out there behind bad media relations people prior to the current staff, because the current staff is outstanding. But a bad public face, I'm sure, interviews and moments in the public eye that the ownership group would really like to take back. They did not do themselves any favors, but there was a watershed moment in this organization when Dan O'Dowd left and Jeff Breidich was hired and Dick Montfort said, I'm going to let my baseball people make baseball decisions and I'm going to step into the background and that's the way this thing is going to be run. Now, I think he probably still has the ultimate final stamp on things that go down, but this is a team that has been built, constructed, molded by Jeff Breidich and Zach Wilson and Chris Forbes and that philosophy, and it's worked. And there is a whole ton of credit that should go to Dick Montfort for being a guy who was able to swallow his pride and say, these are baseball people. Baseball people know baseball. They should be the ones making the decisions. I shouldn't be doing that. It's not easy for an owner to do that, but the fact that he was able to do it is huge. But the biggest credit on the planet goes to Jeff Breidich, a guy who very easily could have fallen into a lot of traps that his predecessor did and completely put his own stamp on this franchise.
There's an easy way to gauge it right here. How many times have you heard Dick Monfort's name in the media this year?
Exactly.
None?
One?
Maybe.
Yeah.
No,
it's true.
That's the point.
It's true.
Because before then, when Dan O'Dowd was there and Bill Guyvette and they're having their power struggle and what the hell ever, and Dick Monfort was sending, nasty messages to fans from his iPad. Like that was the news that came out from the Rockies back in 2013 and 12 and four, whatever, those were the days. That's all we had to talk about because there was such dysfunction in that front office and all the way up to the owner's booth, and you had, Charlie getting DUIs and this kind of stuff. Like that was the Monforts then.
There was some kind of come to Jesus moment.
Yeah, there's some kind of come to Jesus moment with them. But right now, they are not public figures, and that is how ownership should be.
Exactly. And not only that, and this is going to drive the Blame the Monforts crowd crazy, which I think the Rockies making the playoffs does in its own right anyway, but the fact that you have to give Dick Monfort credit for being able to step into the background, you also have to give Dick Monfort a lot of credit for the fact that as an owner, he's done a hell of a good job with that ballpark. He's done a hell of a good job with creating an atmosphere around game days at Coors Field.
Party deck one, the world zero, I will say.
As a businessman and a team owner, he's done a lot of pretty cool stuff for fans and that you want from team ownership. The last piece of the puzzle that needed to fall into place was him saying, yeah, maybe I'm not a baseball executive. Maybe I should let the baseball people do it. And now he's done that. So there's a lot of credit there. But to get to the biggest point, Jeff Breidich and Bud Black and the members of the professional staff and the international staff and the minor league staff, that's where the success lies. And we, for so long, when Jeff Breidich was hired, we started seeing these stamps put on it. Where it was the moment that really stands out to me most was when Yoelis Chacin was released. And there are a lot of stories that came out about that, and I don't want to get into them because a lot of it's speculation, but basically what it seemed like was Jeff Breidich was saying, this is somebody who may need help in certain other areas of his life. He's not committed to what we're doing right here, right now. We don't need him to be a part of this. And it wasn't a DFA. It wasn't a let's try to get him through waivers and see if he'll go to AAA. They cut him loose.
Yep.
And that moment where it was sort of the you're with us or you're against us type of philosophy that sometimes you need in sports, especially if you're trying to change a culture. That's where he really started. That was the first time that I remember thinking to myself, like, man, things are going to be different now.
Yeah.
But, I mean, one of the things that we talked about from his very first free agent signings is the fact that there was a different feel to all of them. The Jake McGee's the world, the Chad Qualls and Jason Mott, which didn't work out. But the types of guys who profiled in a certain way that the Rockies had never really done before.
Yeah.
Like, there was just thought that went into everything. And for Jeff Breidich to be a guy to take that job at 34, 35, whatever he was, stay the course in his first general manager job, and now 3 years into it, see it paying dividends like this, is all the credit in the world to him and to all the guys on that staff.
All right, just 1 second. I'll make sure to check my bank account. And, Dick Monfort's check cleared. So we're good to go. So
is good because I still haven't gotten my Women's March George Soros check.
We don't have to.
Is it George Soros? I don't even remember. Yeah, Soros.
It's like a George Piedra.
Right. Yeah. George Piedra.
Yeah, so we don't have to go back and re-record all of that we just had because the check did clear, so the shills are here.
Thank
for
God.
You guys.
With the dollar signs at the beginning and the end of shills. We're going to talk a lot more about this as things roll along today. We'll get to your Ask PDP questions coming up here. We've got a mega episode today. But for now, let's hear from some of the dudes who are right in the heat of this. When we talk to this team over the last few years, things have felt a lot different than what it was this weekend. And I hope that you'll hear that in some of these guys' voices. John Gray's coming up. Mike Dunn is coming up. You'll hear from Bud Black. You'll hear from Charlie Blackman. You'll hear from Kyle Freeland. You'll hear from 2016 Nolan Arenado and just how different that interview sounds from where we are right now. All that and more, plus Mike Farron a little bit later coming up next. So for the first time since 2009, prior to the advent of Rockies Twitter, the Colorado Rockies are headed to the postseason. And for the first time maybe ever, the Rockies have a legitimate staff ace to turn to. And they've structured things over the last couple of weeks so that John Gray, if they made it into this game on Wednesday, would be the guy to get the ball. And John Gray has been fantastic this year at Chase Field. It's a limited sample size, but he's been outstanding. And you feel confident in going to him. And with the exception of like first half 2011, Ubaldo Jimenez, the Rockies haven't had that many guys that you feel that confident going to. But in a one-game playoff, now you have legit confidence behind a guy.
Yep, this is it. I mean, this is the one guy you'd want. This is the guy that Jeff Bridges drafted. This is the guy that you drafted literally for a situation like this when you picked him third overall. This is John Gray's time.
Exactly. And got a chance to talk to him about that on Friday. So this was prior to the Rockies clinching. Coming into the weekend series against the Los Angeles Dodgers, not playing for anything, Rockies needed a combination of at least one win, at least one Brewers loss, which is exactly how they got it. This is prior to the clinch. Got a chance to talk to John Gray about this past weekend and what was coming up down the pike if the Rockies made it into Wednesday's wildcard game.
So this feels a little bit different coming into this weekend versus weekends and seasons past where it's the end of September. And I mean, the atmosphere right now, there's a ton of media. There's a lot of energy. What is this like from the insider's perspective?
I mean, it's definitely different. You know, we knew it was going to be this way, so, you know, we were prepared for it. But then again, just try to just focus on the game and keep playing the same way.
John, for you guys as a rotation right now, it's been throughout the season, anybody who gets thrown in there who's been in the mix has been good, has been effective. There's so many guys right now who are getting to the end of their longest seasons, but it seems like there's a second win for a lot of them. For you now being your second turn through really in a major league season, what do you communicate to the guys, you know, like Freeland, like Sensatella, guys who haven't done this yet and gotten into this slog this deep in September?
Just to remember everything they were doing. I know a lot of guys were starting. They're in the pen right now, and there's been a lot of moves from the bullpen to starting, but just remember what's effective, what makes you, and go out there and still, you know, keep it the same. Don't change.
The end of that first season when you came up, you kind of said, Coors Field obviously is different, and I know there's something I can figure out about this place. What do you think it's been? I mean, especially the last 3 months for you have been so damn good, but the last 2 years have been really good and really consistent. What do you think you've been able to adapt to about pitching here?
Just the aggressiveness. Like a defensive aggressiveness, I guess. Just going at guys, not giving free bases, not wasting pitches, being completely around the zone but not in the middle, making things look like strikes. I'm drawing as many swings as I can. I want everything to, you know, to look like a meatball down the middle.
There was a whole thing in the Sports Illustrated story earlier this year where I know Kyle was quoted as kind of one of the most effective things about pitching here is if you change your eye level, you kind of change what you're looking for in delivery, especially breaking stuff. It makes it just as effective as if you throw it anywhere else. Have you adapted to kind of using that sort of mentality, or have you changed anything about the way you work with breaking stuff here versus on the road?
Yeah, definitely. It's a drastic change, and you know, you're constantly moving throughout the season. You're going, you know, on the road, home, weeks by weeks, and whatnot. So it's you almost have like two different sets of arsenals. Mm-hmm. Like one for the road, one for home. Here I'm a power pitcher, you know, I got short movement, I'm making everything, you know, jolt to the bottom of the zone looking like a meatball. And on the road I can use the curveball more, just more of like a separation movement type thing. So yeah, you have to work on where you start pitches. Sure.
To come in to this weekend and know that, you know, this is so close now, whatever combination of two, a win here, a Milwaukee loss, whatever it is, you guys are going to be in. Obviously, it's not there yet, but if you're the guy, let's say it's unofficial, but if you're the guy to go in Arizona, if everything comes together, what does that mean to you? Being in this spot right now, still so young, still so early in your career, but being that guy for a franchise?
It's a good thing. I mean, it's a really good thing. It's a great opportunity. I'm just blessed to be in that spot, and you know, I can't wait to fight. Just ready to go at it.
How cool is it to, you know, the fact that you came up with all these guys? There was a story, we had a story on MILB.com today about there's 12 guys on this roster right now that are drafted and developed products in this system. Not everybody has that. I mean, not everybody going into the playoffs relies on a core like that, but to have gone through this with these guys in Modesto and in Tulsa and whatever, what does that add to this experience?
Well, we've personally been through a lot more together, as teammates and through a lot of years and different levels and whatnot, but And then again, like, you know, just tells us our system's working. We're doing really well, and we're bringing guys through, and you know, they've been impact players in this club. So you know, it's just two thumbs up. It's been great.
Is it tough knowing you're gonna have to sit around for the next 3 days and watch this?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, because you can't. Yeah, you can't really do anything. But you know, I'm just gonna be a good cheerleader, and I guess be really loud.
All right, man. Last thing for you. Is OU football for real this year?
I hope so. I remember watching the 2000 national championship. I had like a little party and get together. Like, had people over. Like, it was awesome. And I mean, it's been a while since they've been in that situation. They lost a few, but you know, they look legit. But other years, I've said that too, and they've also. It hasn't turned out that way. I mean, football is kind of weird, but you know, they're showing a lot of promise right now.
You take it one bad week, and Baker Mayfield's not running around punching flagpoles into people's 50-yard lines. But John, thanks, man.
Thank you, appreciate it.
Rockies ace John Gray, who officially, as of Sunday, was named the starter for Wednesday's wild card game at Chase Field in Phoenix, Arizona. There's nobody else you want to turn to in this circumstance.
Nope, this is it. This is your guy. This has been your guy since day one, and he has a chance to prove that. You know, everything is that the Rockies and Jeff Breidich have done since then has been for the right goal.
Colorado Rockies bullpen this year has been, like any bullpen in any season for the Colorado Rockies, a bit up and down. But one of the guys who, maybe the guy who had people most scratching their heads coming into 2017 and beyond was Mike Dunn. People sort of felt like, oh, they gave the Boone Logan money over to Mike Dunn. What's that all about? But Mike Dunn said when he signed with the Rockies, I want to be a part of that team. I want to pitch in Coors Field. I want to make the playoffs with that team. And Mike Dunn struggled in May, struggled in June, was dominant in July, 1.04 ERA, very good August, struggled a little bit in September. You hope things bow back in a good direction. But I got a chance to catch up with Mike Dunn, being one of those guys who came in and left people wondering why on earth you would ever pitch willingly for the Colorado Rockies if this had justified his reasons for coming to Denver.
Last fall/winter, people probably thought you were insane coming here and saying that you wanted to be here, and now that's all justified. This team gets to move on. Your reaction personally to be a part of this and to be such an integral part of this down the stretch and now to have that all rewarded, what's the feeling today coming in?
No, I mean, it's just excitement. You know, it's what we play for. It's what we, you know, train for in the off season, and, you know, ultimately it's why this team got together. Everyone, you know, this is what we wanted, and now we have an opportunity to go, and anything can happen in the playoffs.
One-game playoffs are so weird, but, you know, it's that Game 7 atmosphere right out of the jump. That game in Arizona will be that type of feeling. To be able to know that you guys have gone in kind of playing in survival mode for a few weeks, do you think that plays a factor? Wild card teams always seem like you've got so much more of a sense of urgency and you know how to play in those big games early on in the postseason. Does that play in?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely can. And, you know, at the same time, you know, team just getting hot at the right time and, you know, just ride that hot wave, and, you know, we'll see where it takes us. And, you know, we're going down to Arizona, give them all the credit. They got a great ball club, but, you know, we've played them tough all year long, and, you know, they're not going to throw anything at us that we don't already know, and we're not going to throw anything at them that they don't already know. So it's going to be a grind from the get-go, and like you said, it's going to be Game 7, all hands on deck.
For you guys as a pitching staff, consistency has been there throughout the year, more so than maybe any other year in franchise history. And, you know, the bullpen, you guys get to add somebody like Pat Neshek. You have these arms that have been so effective and have started to come together again as the season goes along. To get to a stretch run and to have everybody throwing pretty well, what does that say about this group and where you guys are?
Oh, I mean, that's exactly what you want. I mean, everyone's had their bumps and over the course of the year, but to add Neshek to the mix, and everyone's starting to throw the ball a lot better, and just as a unit, everyone's throwing the ball great. And, you know, it's the same thing of riding the high. You know, it's, you know, everyone's going to feed off each other, everyone's pulling for each other, and, you know, it's no matter who goes out there, there's confidence, you know, for the whole team that they know that that guy can get the job done.
Last night, you know, these last couple of weeks, obviously kind of stressful. You didn't see teams that start playing well and making up a little bit of ground in Milwaukee and St. Louis. Strange to celebrate before a game, then go out and play a game and come back in. But to come back in, you know, Buddy gives that speech and everybody goes nuts. Take me through just the emotions of that moment and what it was like last night. And were you one of the dudes who jumped in the fountain?
No to the fountain. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, extreme excitement, you know, as authentic as it could have got before the game. And then you got to focus up and you still got to play a baseball game. And, you know, we lost, and it's tough at that, you know, and it's, you know, you got to put that behind you because ultimately our goal was met that we, you know, we're going to the playoffs. And, you know, Buddy come in, gave the speech, and it was just, was 1, 2, 3, go. And I mean, it was awesome. It was a lot of fun.
You guys will give the ball to John, obviously, for, you know, the biggest start of his life, but he's the unquestioned guy in this clubhouse for a game like that. When he's on, which he's been for 2-3 straight months now, what makes him so good? When you watch him as a guy who's a member of the same staff, what makes him effective when he's at his best?
Well, he throws 99, sliders 92 to 93, and, you know, he locates. And it's not that he just throws hard. You know, some guys throw hard, but it's more over the middle of the plate. I mean, he's painting corners, you know, bottom of the zone. And when his slider's on, he's almost unhittable. And, you know, it's going to be great. I mean, he's got the stuff for it. He's got the mentality for it. You know, he deserves it. And, you know, it's our guy to go out there for that game.
All right, man, last thing for you. You know, you get through that game in Arizona, and it's a similar situation with Los Angeles, team you're really familiar with, not throwing anything new, and vice versa. To go into a series like that, I know Mark said yesterday, nobody wants to face you guys in a short series. What is the confidence level and the mentality like going in against a team you already will have seen 18 times and knowing you only need to get 3?
Yeah, I mean, it's our confidence level is going to be, you know, sky high. We've had great success against these guys all year long, and especially against the pitchers that they're going to throw out there. We went into LA. We're not scared to go to LA and play. You know, and like you said, with our lineup, I think, you know, everyone's looking at us like we were the team they didn't want to make it because they knew they didn't want to face us. You know, this is a good ball club, and everybody knows it.
The bullpen, I mean, the pitching staff as a whole. The Rockies coming into this postseason, I think they have the 21st highest WRC plus of any team in Major League Baseball this year. Yeah. Like, they haven't been a dominant offensive group really ever in 2017. And that bullpen they've had to rely on and has gotten the job done. And that done. And Mike Dunn has been a component to that. Has he been as dominant as people would have liked to see? Maybe not. But they've needed him to get big outs at big times. And in July and August, he really did that. That's a huge thing for this team.
And in time when they needed it too. I mean, yeah, you want him to, the overall numbers to be better for Mike Dunn. But, you know, as long as he maybe gets a big out or two or three in the wild card game, all will be forgiven. Same way if Ian Desmond hits like a home run or something.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. 27th in WRC plus out of the 30 Major League Baseball teams, and the Rockies have hit the 21st most home runs in the major leagues.
Weird,
but
right?
The pitching staff has been able to hold the line, and you know what? That's what good teams do. The Rockies' starting group of John Gray, Kyle Freeland, Herman Marquez, Tyler Chatwood, and Antonio Senzatella, of which maybe two of those guys are going to get starts in the postseason. But those guys have all posted ERA plus is better than the major league average, and they've all thrown over 110 innings. The only other time the Rockies have ever done that was 2009 when they made the playoffs and lost to the Phillies in the NLDS. So you feel pretty good about where you are from a pitching standpoint, and that's good. They got to get the bats going, obviously. And one of the guys who you really hope is going to be a dude that gets it going is Charlie Blackmon, and has had it going for the majority of the season. Did have a little bit of a slump in September, but seems to be feeling himself again. This year, he wins a National League Batting Championship, and Nick Groke asked him yesterday if it feels even more special that he wins a batting championship in a year where his team is competing for big things and he's the guy who's able to come through in big spots and
fake
what
champ.
That meant
it was
to him.
Fake batting title. It was a fake batting title.
Yeah, sorry, if the fake batting title. So, the real batting title goes elsewhere.
Thomas Boswell says it's a fake batting title.
Yeah, I can't take I can't take the Nationals or anything about the Nationals seriously.
Not until they win a playoff series for the first time in franchise history.
Charlie Blackmon on how this run to a batting crown felt toward the end of the 2017 season.
Absolutely. You know, you look over, we played 162 games this year. We were the second wild card. You know, we didn't get in by much. But that's all it takes. You know, we got the opportunity. And it makes you realize you know, that one pitch or that one swing or that one play really could be the difference in making the playoffs or not making the playoffs. So I'm happy to celebrate with the guys that did make the playoffs.
Chuck was also asked yesterday about the makeup of this team and the composition of this team. And it's so easy prior to a season to say, yeah, we got something special in this clubhouse. But this team really felt different. And Chuck, the moment that he highlights will not surprise you. But Charlie Blackmon said this team does feel different to him from what he's seen in seasons past.
Yeah, Chuck put up just one of the greatest seasons in recorded history, especially for a leadoff hitter, most RBI to leadoff spot, whatever, blah, blah, blah. His final numbers with the batting title, 331 average, exact OPS of 1,000, 37 homers, 104 ribbies, 14 triples, 35 doubles, 213 hits. I mean, those benchmarks you might not see for a long, long time anymore, especially for a guy who hit first pretty much the entire season. That's an unbelievable season, Coors or not.
Coors. Fake batting title. Charlie Blackmon, the heart and soul of this team for long stretches in 2017, on what made this team different.
I mean, I think this is just a special group. Even spring training, you know, it's easy to say that every year, but I felt like this year has been a little different. I felt like when Nolan hit that walk-off against the Giants, I really sensed that, and I don't get this a lot, you know, play a lot of baseball, and, you know, I got some chill bumps when that happened. I just felt like this year was special.
For the first time in his major league managerial career, Bud Black has successfully piloted a team to the postseason. And yesterday he was asked how, like we asked Mike Farron, how you manage the emotions coming into a game like this. We'll hear from Mike in a little bit on what that means for the Arizona Diamondbacks. This is what Bud Black had to say about managing his team's attitude going into Wednesday in Phoenix.
Well, I think that with this group, and I think I mentioned it this morning as well, it's a, you know, these, most of our players have good heads on their shoulders, and I don't have to worry about, obviously, the focus and the intensity part. You know, I want them to be excited. You know, I want them to enjoy this and be, you know, have that feeling in their stomach about this game. But also know that, you know, we'll talk about, you know, how we play, and there's a looseness, but yet an intensity to it. That we'll talk about, you know, a little bit on Tuesday. You know, there's really not a lot to say in these playoff type games because the guys know what's in front of them.
That game is the thing that everything comes down to. You play 162, it all comes down to one. Everybody gets that. Everybody knows that. But the fact of the matter is you're there now. And for the Rockies, at times in the second half, didn't look like things were going to last, but they've made it through. And this is a team that I think over the last couple of weeks, Anthony, even though we haven't seen them play their best ball, they've seemed to know what is out there. It never seemed like the moment was too big for them, which I think is big.
Well, I mean, you can't understate enough, or overstated enough for that matter, how big this was for Bud Black. I mean, Bud Black's been in the big leagues in some capacity for eons. He's been a manager for over a decade, and this is his first time ever making it to the playoffs. I mean, and especially considering he's come so close and had it ripped away at the last moment, to be able to finally make it through and get to that point, it's such a huge watershed moment for Bud Black, and I feel like a weight's got to be lifted off his shoulders, right? I mean, because he's always been seen as that guy, like, oh, you know, great guy, very personable. Mike Farron even says everybody loves him. But at the same time, he's never been able to get his team to the mountaintop, even just to the playoffs, not even the World Series, just to the playoffs. And so having him be able to be in charge of this team in his first year in Denver, it says a lot about what he brought, how the players respond to him. And, you know, kudos to the front office for taking a chance on a guy that when he got hired, we were all kind of a little bit curious about it. I know they'd wanted Bud Black for a long time, a pitcher's manager, for a guy in Colorado to work on the pitching, yada, yada, yada. To have them, to bring them in year one and have him make the postseason, it says a lot about how much this team really does rely on Bud Black and how well he has done taking them through some of the ebbs and flows we've had throughout the course of 162-game season.
And this is Bud Black and his message to his team going into Wednesday.
There's not much we can tell them. They're ready to play. You know, these guys are ready. I think I said this morning that, you know, there's no secrets here between the Diamondbacks and us. We've played them, you know, obviously 19 times this season. They know us. We know them. It's going to come down to, you know, who plays the better game. You know, who pitches well, who gets key hits, who makes a play. Should be a really good game.
Bud Black also took time yesterday to acknowledge what the fans have meant to this team over the course of the 2017 season. They made an announcement at Coors Field yesterday in the press box that the 2017 combined attendance across every game at Coors Field is 2,953,650 fans. That's the largest home attendance number since 2001. So baseball is dying. Mark Kisla told us, we all know, baseball is dead. But that's pretty awesome.
Eighth in all of baseball, right, I believe?
Yeah. Yeah, I believe that is correct.
Yeah.
So, pretty good. And Bud Black took time to acknowledge the fans that have helped him and his team along in 2017.
You know, the first game of the year, that Friday afternoon, which is a tradition here in Denver, our opening game, what a great crowd that was. I think the crowds here this weekend were also very special. And I think in between, you know, I saw, you know, an involvement of our fans as, you know, they realized, you know, what we had going on. And, I mean, the crowd was great. This is a great sports town. You know, it has a great following of football, basketball, and hockey and baseball. You know, they get into their teams, and I think, you know, this team here was one that they could, you know, be proud of. And they showed up, man. I love when I leave the park and come to the park, different license plates from the, you know, surrounding areas, which is great. You know, they're loud. You know, when it gets, you know, when it gets exciting, they can pull the guys through, which is awesome. So I can't say enough about the fans. They've been really, really good this year.
Rockies manager Bud Black. One other guy that wanted to talk to a little bit yesterday and got a chance to catch up with very briefly was Kyle Freeland. Kyle got the ball yesterday. The Rockies didn't want to throw Tyler Anderson out there once more in case he's needed in a relief capacity potentially on Wednesday in Arizona. That was something that Bud Black said could be in the cards when the Rockies take on the D-backs. Kyle Freeland gets the nod. The Denver kid starts the home opener, finishes the season at home for Colorado, and gets to do that walk around the warning track at Coors Field, which since the inaugural season, the Rockies have done that every year. They acknowledge the fans. More often than not, that's it for Rockies baseball in any given season. But Kyle Freeland, he's been in the stands to see that from the other side, and I asked him what it felt like yesterday to be on the field side of that and get a chance to salute the fans wearing the purple pinstripes at Coors Field.
It was special. Heard a few shouts of my name, you know, people who, you know, saying go TJ or something like that. It was a special moment to, you know, see everyone cheering and be happy for what we've accomplished so far.
So many of these years have ended with that being the last moment of Rockies baseball for a season, but knowing that there's still more to do, how does that change the feeling among you guys as a group? You go out there, you have that connection with the fans, but it's not done yet.
The feeling I got was, you know, we were walking into this clubhouse and we knew there was more baseball to play. It wasn't, we did our best, and now let's pack up and go home. We know that there's baseball to be played, and we got business to take care of.
The Denver native Kyle Freeland, and that was the last step at home in the regular season in Coors Field in 2017. A chance for more, but the Rockies got to get through the D-backs coming up on Wednesday. But that brings us to our final audio of this episode, and we're going to turn the clock back 13 months or so to episode number 84, I believe it was, of the PDP, in which Nolan Arenado joined the show. And we got a chance to talk about, you know, the Rockies were hanging in. The Rockies played some pretty good ball. They got to the beginning of August last year, and they were still right in the mix. They had a big homestand in which they saw some teams come in. They were trying to chase down in the playoff race. The Dodgers, the Marlins came to town. They were taking on the Rangers when Nolan and I sat down to have this conversation. But the big point of it was, hey, man, you guys are pretty close. And this just stuck with me all week because when you saw Nolan when they clinched, when you saw Cargo when they clinched, all these guys who have been around, you could tell how much it meant. And that homestand against the Dodgers and the Marlins and the Rangers did not go well last year. They went 3-5. They fell pretty much out of the playoff spot. They were a 500 team going into it, and they really didn't do anything down the stretch.
No.
But this team finished where that team didn't, and that's what felt so different.
I mean, it really was at the beginning of the month, we kind of thought that this might be the beginning of the end for the Rockies. And we were saying that, oh, well, here's when they blow it. Oh, here's when they blow it. And then they lost, like, you know, five in a row. And then they went out and they won six straight at LA and Arizona.
Makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it was that stretch where they got swept at home by the D-backs to begin the month of September. And then even when they, you know, they went and lost that game at against San Diego, then lost the next two at San Francisco, lost the first game of that series where we had done our last podcast. We're saying, oh, if they lose this one, it's probably over. And then they lost it. And then they eventually righted the ship enough while I was out of the country. So good for them. But we thought that every single loss in September was going to be the beginning of the end. And this team showed the fortitude and the resiliency to get back up and realize that they're not all as hothead idiots as we are, and that's a good thing.
True. That is a very good thing. 2016, Nolan Arenado. And while you listen to this for a few minutes, just keep in mind what Nolan sounded like and what he looked like this week and how the seeds for that you can kind of see sown in what we discussed last year.
You know, kind of still experiencing some firsts in your career, and it's at this stage, the first time at this point in the season where you guys are really hanging in. What's this feel like? I mean, being able to come to the park every day, I know that you're really playing for something.
Yeah, well, it feels good, you know that we can compete. Obviously, you know, we feel that we can hang with any team that we've played, and you know, obviously our starting pitching has set the tone for us, and that's where it all starts. But we're playing good ball, and, you know, we're only 4 games out of the wild card, 8 out of the division, and we know we haven't played our best ball yet, but we're playing good baseball, and it's been fun, and it's nice to look at the scoreboard and see what other teams are doing in a way, because we know we have a chance.
You guys, this homestand comes with such a different atmosphere and such different energy, because you meet 2 teams you're chasing down, the Dodgers and Marlins, and then a really good team comes in today in the Rangers. What does that energy do for you guys when you come to the park? You know, there's 40,000 people here yesterday. It just feels different. For you guys in this room, what does that mean when you head out on the field and you know that? Not only is it different for what you're playing for, but it seems like compared to August games last few seasons, this is way different, I would imagine.
Yeah, yeah. No, it feels good. It feels really good. It's nice to know that our fans are there for us. I think they're starting to get the clue that, you know, we're kind of in it, you know, and the couple years past, we haven't been in it at all. So I think the fans are understanding that, hey, you never know what can happen here. And we need that support. You know, we feed off them. We love the energy. You know, if you see a lot of the good teams in baseball, you know, their fan base is usually a big part of that, you know, their home field advantage. And we need that. And we need that with them. And it's nice. It's nice coming to ballpark, seeing a packed house, especially on a Sunday day game. You know, there's a lot of other things people could be doing, but they're coming to our game. So it means a lot. And it's something that, you know, it pushes me to play even harder for them. And, you know, like I said, we have a chance.
Like you said, starting pitching has really been kind of the key to it. And it seems like, you know, when John gets a ball, obviously yesterday a little tough for him, but when he gets a ball, when Tyler gets a ball, all these guys, they bring what feels like a different mentality coming in that you feel like you have a stopper, I would imagine, rather than some of these slides the last couple of seasons where it just felt like nobody was ever there to put an end to it. What has that been like, being able to go behind somebody that you know is more than likely going to go out and give you 6-7 innings and really give you a chance?
Well, it's been great. I mean, it's been great. You know, knowing that, you know, we have a guy like, you know, obviously Rick Gray had a rough outing, you know, yesterday. But, you know, unfortunately those things happen, and he's going to bounce back like we expect him to. But, yeah, you know, like we lost in New York, the Mets, you know, even though we lost the last day. And, you know, we were playing the Dodgers the first game, and I knew Gray was throwing. And it gives you self-confidence. Like, okay, we got Gray throwing. This is good. We got a good chance to win this game. You know, even whoever they're throwing, we still feel good about ourselves. Because we know if he's on his game, you never know what could happen. So it's a great feeling. All our starting pitching has been good. They're competing, and they're giving us a chance, and they're giving our bullpen a chance, you know, and giving our bullpen rest, too. And that's a big thing, you know, because we're not exposing them as much as we were in the past, and that's a big thing for us.
At this stage for you as a leader in this clubhouse, I mean, obviously there was, you know, the game in San Diego earlier this year where you were getting guys fired up. You hit the home run yesterday. That comes in a big spot, and you're an emotional guy. You're a guy who's out there on the front line getting everybody kind of off of, you know, if there is a Schneid, getting them off of a Schneid. When it comes to this stage in a season, first time that you guys have experienced what feels like a postseason run in your career, what changes with that? I mean, does that take on more meaning? Does it take on more immediacy to be one of those guys who's out front leading when you know that this is so close? You're only 4 games out.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just going to keep doing my thing. I'm going to keep working hard, keep being there for the guys. You know, obviously, you know, I want to perform because I want to help the team win, you know, and I think we all have to understand we have to play our spot. But, you know, we got to clear our heads. You know, that's something, you know, I have to learn. You know, we all have to learn is that we're in a race now. So when you lose, you got to move on quick, you know, because we got to get ready for the next day. And, you know, obviously we lost a really bad game yesterday, but we move on. We got the Rangers in town, got a tough series, but we got to get ready. Be ready to play every single day, and I think that's what we're doing, and we're having success right now.
Last thing for you. You guys, right now, it feels like you're competing maybe a year ahead of schedule. I think everybody figured 2017 and beyond was going to be a really good stretch. How do you guys take the long view, or do you think about that at all? I mean, the fact that you've got so much talent, even just the guys that have come up this season that have already been able to contribute, but there's so many guys in Albuquerque. There's so many guys in Hartford. How do you guys look at what opens up next year and beyond in terms of, you know, you're in it right now, but this could be a regular feeling for a while?
Yeah, I mean, it feels good. You know, obviously, we know that. You know, we've always heard that, but you know, for the guys that are in here, they want to hear that. You know, they want to hear about us being good now. You know, it's you can't look to the future. You know, you got to focus on now, and we're focused on that, and we want to prove people wrong, and we feel good about our team and what we have here. And you know, obviously, we know we have a lot of pieces that can help us win. You know, if we keep playing where we are, those pieces are going to help us this year, and that's what we need. And we're very happy with what's going on. But, you know, we're not content. You know, being average isn't very good. You know, being average in the major leagues doesn't get you nowhere. So, you know, we're trying to get to the postseason, and we know we have to play above that.
Nolan Arenado, John Gray, Mike Dunn, Kyle Freeland, Charlie Blackman, Bud Black. Big thanks to all those guys. But it was a fun weekend at Coors Field, and it has been a fun season for Colorado Rockies baseball, and there is still more work to be done. On Wednesday, the Rockies and the Arizona Diamondbacks will do battle in the postseason for the second time in the history of the rivalry between these two franchises. Hopefully it turns into an actual rivalry this time, which it should have in 2008 and beyond, but it didn't. Mike Farron knows more about the Arizona Diamondbacks organization than maybe any other man on the planet. Joins us to preview Wednesday, talk about the D-backs, talk about the Rockies, and a whole lot more coming up next. Well, coming up on Wednesday, the Colorado Rockies are headed to Phoenix, Arizona, and despite what Tracy Ringlesby would say on MLB Network, not Bank One Ballpark, but we'll call it the Bob anyway. And with that, we will bring in longtime friend of the PDP, Mike Farron, the pre- and post-game show host for the Arizona Diamondbacks, fill-in play-by-play dude and all-around good guy. That's what we'll call Mike for the full intro. That's your full title. Hi, Mike.
2 out of 3 ain't bad.
So give us the mood right now. I mean, it's this has sort of felt since May like this was going to be the reality for these two teams, really since June when the Dodgers really started to take off. But it felt all year like it was going to be 3 teams coming out of this division. 2 of them would have to play for this wild card. And now this is what it's down to. What is the mood around D-backs land right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's I wish I had one word that would describe it. I think that there's probably this weird concoction of anxiety and excitement. So I don't know what anxiety meant. You know,
I'm good with that.
Or anxiety.
Anxiety. Yeah.
It's like, you're excited for a chance to play in the postseason. And, you know, I would assume I should never assume because I know what happens when you do that. But, you know, the two teams that had winning records in the West against the Dodgers this year were the D-backs and the Rockies. And that's who's waiting in the division series. Right. Like there's pretty high degree of confidence that they can play with L.A. So but it all could be over on Wednesday. So
right. It's
a weird thing, right? I mean, like, you're super excited to be in the postseason, and all of a sudden it could be over, Wednesday night. And that does not seem right. You know, it doesn't seem like, you know, certainly I don't think anybody wants the season to end. On either side, I can just speak to the D-backs. It's been a really special year, and it would be a shame if the season came to an end, you know, at the hands of the Rockies.
Mike, the Rockies did not play great ball down the stretch, and for a while it kind of looked like, is this team going to make it at all? The D-backs separated themselves with that one good run, but it's been a pretty inconsistent second half for them, too. What is the move? I mean, it's baseball. When you get into this part of the season, you want to be playing your best ball, but you play 9 bad innings. You play 1 bad inning on Wednesday, and everything goes down the drain. How would you evaluate the second half since a good start?
You know, I probably have a little bit different take. I think it's just baseball more than anything, right? I mean, you're going to have stretches of time where you don't play well. And really, if you look at it, the one bad stretch of games for the D-backs was when they got swept in L.A. in July and then dropped 2 out of 3 at home to Cincinnati and got swept in Atlanta right after the break. And they dropped 8 of 9 there. And then for the most part, you know, they kind of played 500 ball for a while after that. And then they got on that huge, you know, win streak. And then they played pretty much 500 ball down the stretch. So I don't know that I necessarily look at it. I think what's been really interesting is that there really wasn't, maybe outside of when they got swept in Minnesota, there wasn't a whole lot of down when the down times were happening. I think that they have both the makeup of the young players and the veterans that they brought in. They're pretty consistent personalities. And so I think that probably, you know, went a long way to helping them cope with, you know, what I think could have spiraled out of control for a lot of young teams. So I really have never, despite what I've read from the outside and even from people covering the team on, you know, this has been a bad stretch or this, I've never really felt that in the clubhouse. I think that they've been pretty consistent in that regard. And I don't know, maybe it's because I'm so used to taking 30,000 foot snapshots of what's going on that it doesn't really, to me, it didn't seem like there was anything that was, you know, really untowards or where you went, oh my gosh, this team is playing so poorly right now. There's no way they're going to make it.
Oh, that's fun. We thought that, I think, pretty much every day for the last 4.5 months, and yet still here we are, Rockies in the playoffs. If you took the temperature of Rockies Twitter on any given day, even from inning to inning or game to game, you would have thought the world had been ending since basically the end of June?
Since the dawn of Twitter.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, I don't want you to think that I'm in the majority and that maybe I'm just an emotionless sociopath, you know? That could
well, I could be.
So.
Speaking of emotionless sociopaths, Zach Greinke starting for the...
Oh, wow, that is really mean.
That was oh my goodness. Rude.
No,
yeah, ouch.
Sorry, that was too much on a tee. Zach Greinke is a fantastic player, and actually, I do want to talk about Zach Greinke, but it was just too perfect for my next question. But actually, though, Zach Greinke's been really good at Chase Field this year, and he's facing a guy who's been John Gray, who has been also very good at Chase Field this year. Zach Greinke, after second year of his big contract, the first year did not really play that way.
Mike, are you peeing on the phone right now?
No, sorry, I was just washing my hands. I got it from walking the dogs.
Oh, man, we are so off the rails. I love it.
This is great. Fantastic. This is terrific. You're taking pot shots at someone you don't even know. That seems like
Anthony. And then Mike's peeing on the phone. What's going on here?
Come on, guys.
It's my retribution.
I read Molly Knight's book. It was all in good fun. But no, Zach Greinke this year at home, 13-1, 287 ERA. John Gray's only two starts with 10 strikeouts this year, both at Chase Field. So the pitching matchup is going to be a fantastic event for both these two teams. But Zach Greinke's last year at home, he really, really struggled in 2016 at Chase Field. Couldn't quite figure out how he wanted to pitch there. He went 5-5 with an ERA close to 5. What was the biggest difference you saw from Zach Greinke, especially at Chase Field this year?
Well, I don't know that I can put a finger specifically on like what he did differently at Chase Field compared to what he did on the road. I mean, I think the biggest thing to me was he made a pretty significant adjustment about the middle of April. He got knocked around at Dodger Stadium. And we know what Greinke had been the last several years, right? I mean, it's, you know, plus secondaries with an above average fastball and double plus fastball command, right? He could put the fastball wherever he wanted. Really lost a little bit of the velocity. And the changeup being his primary, you know, out pitch didn't seem to be working against better lineups the same way. And so he made an adjustment, I think, both with his slider, although he hasn't talked about it, and certainly with the usage of it, to give it more depth. It breaks really late. And I think that that's what's changed for Greinke more than anything this year, is that he's, instead of being a fastball changeup guy, is now a fastball slider guy, still with a really good changeup, still with a really good slower curveball.
Huh.
And that's been the biggest difference to me. And I think it bears out in the numbers, too, because you look and you see that he has the highest strikeout rate of his career. I mean, I think he's striking out something like 27% of batters or close to it, which is pretty high for him. So that, to me, was the biggest change with him. But I don't know that it's necessarily anything, you know, it's not like he's all of a sudden this, you know, crazy two-seam 60% ground ball guy. You know, he hasn't turned into Tyler Chatwood in that regard. What he has done, though, is really been able to manage counts. You know, he knows when to pick at the corners. He knows, you know, how to get guys to chase out of the zone. And he has new tools at his disposal, both in terms of what they're doing in advanced scouting and data in the front office, and having both Dan Heron and Burke Badenhop to be able to work with to really help devise a game plan. And Jeff Mathis, who, you know, Mathis is likely going to start the wild card game, and I think people would look from the outside and go, well, how can he start when Chris Iannetta's numbers offensively are so good? But Mathis and Greinke have a really good rapport, and you know, we know one of the things that's really difficult to quantify is game calling, and Mathis is really good at that, and he and Greinke have a great relationship. So I think all of those things have factored together to help Zach Greinke have the year that he has.
Mike, these two teams have played 19 times. The D-backs won 11 of those matchups. The Rockies obviously went in a huge series at the last time they went into Chase Field, won the first two, which they very badly needed to do. Games are usually pretty entertaining. They're two teams that have known each other for quite some time, but they know everything about each other. And this isn't a sport like football in which you can get into the conference championship game, play a divisional opponent, and you can run out some wrinkle in your offense and everything looks different. There's nothing you can change. And everybody in the clubhouse yesterday was saying that in Denver, which, you know, is the one take that you can really have. We know everything about each other. Not a whole lot of wrinkles here. You go out and you play. How does that factor in to a game like this on Wednesday, there aren't many cards you can hold up your sleeve to play anything different. I mean, this is going to be the 20th game between these two teams this year. How does that play a role?
Right. There are no secrets between these two teams, right?
So it's like the frozen tundra of Lambeau Field.
I think it's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, you could see some variation in the way, you know, hitters are attacked. I mean, I think what's interesting about Gray's last start here is that, you know, he went to the curveball a lot more. In fact, I think he threw more breaking pitches than he did fastballs in that start against the D-backs in the middle of September. And that's not something that he's done all that frequently this year. I know he uses the curveball more on the road than he does at Coors, but you know, does he stick with that same game plan or does he go to something that's a little bit more traditional, you know, when push comes to shove, because he's got, you know, 97, 98 in his back pocket. You know, with Greinke, it's, you know, Greinke's accumulated a lot of data about these hitters and he's faced them a lot, right? So how do you try and, the way I would look at it is how do you minimize the damage that their offense can present, right? How do you keep Charlie Blackmon to singles? How do you keep, you know, how do you, you know, pitch around DJ LeMahieu's strengths? You know, what do you do to try and get Arenado behind in the count where you have a chance to finish him off? How do you keep the ball away from Cargo, knowing that when you get into his swing plane that it's going to go, you know, 500 feet? How do you get out Trevor Story, who's had Greinke's number to some degree over the last 2 years, although I think Greinke has pitched better against him the last couple of outings? So I think there's a lot of different factors that kind of go into play there. And I think to me what's interesting is, okay, how much different are they going to pitch against these lineups this time? And what are the adjustments the lineups make? You know, are the D-backs looking for Gray to be more breaking ball heavy than he had been, you know, and you know, certainly that helped him a lot to have success. And if so, are they going to get surprised with his heater? You know, like, how do you plan for that? How do you get ready? And then the other part is, like, whatever your game plan is, how do you implement it? And I think that that's, you know, whether that's, you know, running or whether it's, you know, trying to put the ball in play more, if it's, you know, how quickly you want to get into your bullpen, because I think as we've seen as the years gone on, both teams have some questions in that pen, right? For Torrey Lovello, it's like, when do you deploy Archie Bradley, right? Like, it's like, when do you release the hounds, right?
It's so the Andrew Miller thing from last year, yeah.
Exactly. I mean, yeah. Like, where's that right sixth spot? Yeah. And how do you, like, and especially with a guy like Greinke, right? Like, okay, you know, how many batters faced is he going to end up with? Like, that to me is a huge question. Like,
sure.
Is it some point in the third time through the order, like, as he's getting to the heart of it, that you go to the bullpen? I mean, I'm sure the score will dictate some of that. So I think it's probably more, I think it's less about the matchups and more about the sense of urgency that has to come in one game. And, you know, I think the Rockies may have a little bit of an edge in this, just from, not that I think that Bud Black is a better manager than Torrey Lovello, although I think Buddy is very good. You guys know how I feel about Buddy.
Yeah.
He's been through this game before, right? 10 years right. ago, he was managing the Padres when Matt Holliday didn't touch the plate. And sorry.
How dare you?
Oh, everyone's taking pot shots today. I get it.
I know. Just gotta do it, right? So, he's been through that before. He's been through that winner-take-all game as a big league manager. And I do think that experience gives him a little bit of an advantage, and then it's going to be a matter of how do you deploy things. Because I think, you know, Bradley is the best reliever on either of the two teams. And he hasn't pitched well his last two outings, but those are really the only two outings and the only back-to-back outings that he hasn't pitched well all season. So if he's riding the emotion and the waves of what's going on in that ballpark and the energy in it, you know, it's going to be very difficult in those couple of innings that he pitches, I think, for the Rockies hitters. And so we'll see how it shakes out. I mean, to me, I think it's a really it's going to be really interesting to see when those resources get deployed and how they get deployed.
Now, let me ask you this as a follow-up to that, because this question was posed to Bud Black yesterday. There are a ton of guys in that clubhouse, both in Denver and in Phoenix, who have never been in this position before as players. And when you are somebody in the spot of an Archie Bradley, somebody, you know, even in the spot of a John Gray, although it's obviously a very different role between those two guys, managing your emotions, managing your energy coming into a game like this is a whole different beast from anything that you face in your professional career, really. Because, you know, I mean, even Archie Bradley pitched in, you know, he was in the Southern League Championship Series, a fantastic minor league pitcher, all that kind of stuff. Nothing compares to what Wednesday is going to be. So for these young guys, and even for somebody, you know, Paul Goldschmidt finished the regular season 0-17. He's maybe the greatest hitter in baseball, goes in a little bit cool. Everything gets thrown into this bizarre one-game thing. Nothing in baseball comes down to one game except for Game 7, but now we have this. How do you manage that? If you're Torey Lovello, if you're that staff, how do you manage those emotions, those personalities going into something like Wednesday?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I'll go back to, so watching this happen in a playoff game with somebody who was more experienced. So in 2014, I got to get the years right. I was on the NLCS coverage for Sirius, and that was Giants Cardinals, right? And that was the year that Mike Morse hit the game tying home run in the bottom of the eighth inning, right? And AT&T Park goes absolutely berserk. Right. The place is just going crazy. And all of a sudden, Santiago Casilla has to get loose. Right. And get going to pitch the ninth to hold it as a tie game so that they can try and come back. And of course, we know how it ends up finishing, right, with Ishikawa hits the walk off and they go to the World Series again and they've gone to win another World Series championship. But Santiago Casilla goes sprinting out of the dugout. And this is a guy who's, you know, this ain't his first rodeo, racing out there, goes out, and his first warm-up pitch on the field at AT&T, you know, where the bullpens are on the field, goes to the backstop behind home plate. And Casilla was so amped up from that situation that he ended up loading the bases in that ninth inning and had to get out of a huge jam, like got out of a jam in order to survive in that game. And I think that's why it's such a great question about how you manage it. You know, Archie has been in one of those situations before, albeit to a lesser degree, against Los Angeles. He had to rush to get ready, came into a bases loaded jam, walked the first guy he faced with, I think, give him a single and then a walk with the bases loaded to allow LA to score a run, and then got out of it. And he spoke to how he needed to control his emotions there. So I think that that's an interesting point that you bring up, and I can only speak to it from Archie's standpoint. Now, some of the guys in Colorado's pen have been through it. Greg Holland has been there, right? I mean, he's done it. Pat Neshek has done it. You know, Fernando Rodney has done it. I'm not sure that Fernando Rodney is affected by anything. I mean, that guy is like, he's like the
Marshawn Lynch of Major League Baseball.
Except that he's willing to talk. Have you ever talked to Fernando?
No,
he's
I've not.
Freaking
actually.
Awesome! Like, this guy is like, he's great. He's beloved by teammates and always has been. And I think a big part of it is because he just is like the most chill dude in the world. You wouldn't know whether or not he'd locked down a game or blown it. And I think that that's one of the reasons why teams have kept going to him as their closer, is that he's just not affected by the last outing. And so you've got some guys that have experienced it. I think where it comes in is, okay, let's say you get to a middle inning spot and Buddy goes to Antonio Senzatella with men on base, right? Which isn't something that he's going to very often, but let's say that that's where the spot is. Or if it's, you know, Andrew Chafin in a big spot against Charlie Blackmon on the other side. Those guys haven't had a chance to manage their emotions in those situations. Yeah. That, to me, is the big focus forward, is how quickly can you slow the game down? How are you able to take a deep breath and channel that energy in a way that doesn't let things spiral out of control? And there really is no preparation for it, in my mind, as to how you can do it unless you've experienced it to some degree. And that's one of those, that's why I bring up the story with Archie Bradley, is because I saw that happen and I listened to his reaction after it. And that was pretty impressive to me, that he realized, okay, this was basically a trial run for what's going to happen, because he's going to pitch in a big spot on Wednesday night.
Yeah. And a lot of that is about those managers putting those guys in the right situations for them to succeed. Mm-hmm. And we've seen all year, it could be the 1-2 in NL Manager of the Year rankings this year, and Torey Lovello and Bud Black, both guys did so well in their first seasons. What makes Torey Lovello such an amazing facilitator of, I don't know, like what makes him so good? He seems to have had his finger on the pulse of his team from day one. It seems to have not wavered at all this season.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of similarities between Buddy and Torey. And I think we talked about that earlier this summer, right? I mean, that they're both, you know, the word communicator gets thrown around an awful lot, right? But think about the people that you've worked for, who you've really appreciated working for. And they're the ones who know when it's the right.
For Anthony, that's me, just so everybody knows.
I do nothing
for
this podcast.
Okay, so think about how you would like to work for somebody better.
Yes.
What they might bring to the table. No, but so, I mean, like, I think he knows when's the right time to put an arm around a guy and when's the right time to put a foot in their backside. And I think he's let the players, you know, he's a really consistent demeanor, and which is what Bud Black is too. There's no panic ever, right? I mean, there's a reason why Bud Black survived four general managers in San Diego. Think about that. He was there for 9 years. He had four bosses. And it's because he's really good at talking to players. He's really good at talking to anybody. If you spend 5 minutes with Buddy, you feel like you've known him for 50 years. And that's the same with Torrey. You know, they care about people. They care about the people that are their subordinates. And they know how to communicate and to share their ideas with their bosses in a manner that's respectful, but also, you know, lets them know that their opinion is important. And I think that that's a big factor as to why he's had the success. We can talk about in-game moves or in-game maneuvers all we want with any manager, and not a single one of them is perfect. You know, I think personally, I think Joe Girardi is about the best manager of a bullpen in baseball, and he gets it wrong time and time again, right? But what these guys are able to do and what Torrey is able to do in those other hours, in making sure that the players know that he has their back, that there's no panic, that there's consistent, you know, really a consistent level of both preparation and attitude and all of that, I think is what makes Torrey special.
Mike, the D-backs' road to get to this point has been very different from the Rockies. For the Rockies the last several seasons, it's been the Jeff Breidich model, draft and develop, fill in some guys in the bullpen, especially where you need them, but mostly you're going to be built around a homegrown core. The D-backs have a lot of those guys. They also made a massive trade acquisition at the deadline, J.D. Martinez, who's been a phenomenon since then. Zach Greinke cost a whole ton of money. They're built in a slightly different way. What does that say about the front office being able to stick with things after what a disaster last year was, to bring it back this year, get this team under a manager who was going to handle it well, and be able to get to this point in a season now back in the playoffs?
I think it shows a significant amount of intelligence, because I don't think anybody would have faulted the front office from coming in and blowing things up, right? I mean, you had players that are getting close to free agency like Pollock and Goldschmidt and Corbin. You know, you had guys that would be attractive pieces on the trade market, and you need to find a way to keep guys cost controlled in a market like Phoenix. So I think patience is it's something that we don't have as fans, but I think it's a really important aspect of both player development and management. And I don't think it's any coincidence that, you know, two teams that overachieved in 15 and underachieved in 16 turned over their front office, and their front office didn't really do much of anything. And it's not a surprise that both of those teams as a result are in the wild card game, because what you saw with the D-backs and what you saw with the Minnesota Twins are pretty similar, right? Feel like you've got a good core of young, talented players that didn't work out last year. Let's not panic. Let's keep things together. Let's try and augment it with a couple of moves. Let's try and see if we can build on the success we had. You know, the big one this winter in Minnesota was adding Jason Castro. The big one in Arizona was probably trading for Taiwan Walker and Ketel Marte. You know, and you know, add in on the fringes in free agency where they got better defensively behind the plate, did Arizona. And, you know, they tried to find, you know, pieces over the course of the season in Minnesota that would work, you know, on the pitching side. But I think that that's the part of it that's interesting to me, is recognizing right away, okay, there's talent here. Let's wait and evaluate. Let's give these players a chance to play. And I think that that's the thing that's most interesting to me. You know, the Jeff Breidich model isn't all that different from the Dan O'Dowd model in terms of drafting and developing players, right? I mean, that's what Dan did for the most part.
Or attempted to, right?
I mean, I think because Jeff isn't a media darling, I don't think he gets quite the attention that he deserves. He's a pretty sharp dude. I mean, you guys have dealt with him for a long time.
Yeah.
And he's also sneaky funny. Like, I like to give him a hard time because he's from Wisconsin. And so in spite of that, I like him. But I think what you see is the similarity between both the front offices, that they're both development-based front offices. You know, Mike Hazen was the director of player development, assistant director in Cleveland, and then director in Boston. You know, Jeff was in charge of the player development in Colorado. And so there tends to be a level of patience. You know, be patient with the players we have. We believe in them. We know how to evaluate our own guys, so we don't over-evaluate them, but we also trust that we have talent and that they can have success.
Mike, couple more for you. We'll get you out of here. One, just a very selfish question for me and Anthony, but we both worked with J.J. Hoover in 2010 in Myrtle Beach, and he has played a pretty big role in these last couple of months. He only had a couple of appearances in August, but was good. 13 appearances in September, an ERA of 2.70. He has been such an enigma for teams to try to figure out how to get the most out of him. It always seemed like he was going to be best suited for a bullpen role. Do you think he factors into a game like this? How has he been used, and is that step forward a legit step forward for who?
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, he's had some big moments, including one where he came into to like a first and second nobody out jam against the heart of the Marlins order, which is no joke, right? I mean, he had to face what Stanton, Yelich, Ozuna, and struck out two of them and got out of it with no damage. And that was a big moment for him in a big game for the D-backs as they got closer to clinching. You know, I think he's going to factor in probably. My guess is that he is on the wild card roster, and that if he is, that he's going to be used as a guy that's going to attack right-handed hitters. I mean, I would think that he's going to face guys like Arenado, that he would face, you know, Story, and, you know, certainly Desmond Reynolds, those guys. You know, the slider has been really good, and I think he's up to slider usage this year. You know, the key for him is when he's got a little bit of life on his fastball, because it's not overpowering. It's 93-94, but he's got kind of a weird arm action that lets the fastball jump on hitters when he's right. And when he does that, that it's really good. And I think he will potentially play a factor in the wild card game. I just think I have been led to believe that the D-backs are going to actually have four starting pitchers active for that game. And Corbin and Godley are the two guys to keep an eye on out of the bullpen, because they both pitched this weekend in Kansas City. And I would not be surprised if they pitch in big spots. Both of them have experience pitching out of the pen and having success in the pen in the big leagues. And I would be stunned if there weren't key spots that those guys were counted on, either for a ground ball in the case of Godley, or to attack like Cargo in a big situation for Corbin or Charlie Blackmon.
And Godley's done really well against the Rockies this year, too. He's kind of owned them this year in his two or three starts.
Yeah, he's pitched really well in the division. I mean, he keeps the ball on the ground. I mean, it's close to 60% ground ball rate.
The other thing that's really annoying about this D-backs team is, like, they're all likable dudes, too. Like, it's easy to not like the Dodgers. It's easy, whatever. But, like, Archie Bradley, friendly guy. Taijuan Walker, friendly guy. Paul Goldschmidt seems like he'd be a hell of a fun dude to have a beer with. Like, that's annoying.
Yeah, I mean, that's we like being friendly. It's horrible. Horrible being
health of this
good dudes that you have to root for. What an awful.
It's
awful.
Terrible. Just awful. It's terrible. I only have room for so many people I can like on the planet. I can't like people on other teams. It's obnoxious. Health of this team right now, it's always a factor going into the postseason regardless, but a couple of guys have been hampered over the last few days, hobbled by some stuff. What is the health situation going into Wednesday?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the big one is with Ketel Marte, who left Sunday's game with hamstring tightness, and he's done a really good job at shortstop. I know he had two errors on Sunday, but for the most part, he's made the routine plays. It hasn't always looked pretty, but he's recorded the outs, and I think there's a ton of talent there. He was swinging the bat really well, too. So the D-backs, who had a lot of middle infield depth coming into the season, are a little short there now. Nick Ahmed is out. You know, he was literally one at-bat away from rejoining the team after having a broken hand and got hit on the wrist with a pitch on a rehab assignment and was lost for the rest of the season, right? So you break your hand in two different spots twice in the same year. Chris Owings is also out with a broken right middle finger, is just now facing some live pitching in instructional league as he tries to get ready to potentially join the postseason roster. So that, to me, is the biggest impact that could be had injury-wise, because if it's not Marte, then you're looking at, you know, either Adam Rosales, who's a veteran who's got experience, but
had a good year too.
Surest thing. Yeah, had a nice year, especially against lefties. You're either looking at him at shortstop, or you're looking at someone like, and this is a name that may factor in, Christopher Negron, who's been a super utility guy over the last couple of years, but there's a feeling that he is, among the D-backs reserves, the best defensive shortstop in the bunch.
Wow.
So, yeah. So that's interesting in that, you know, if that factors in. Now, we'll see what happens. It could be that, you know, they were saying Marte was day-to-day. Hopefully he's ready to go Wednesday. My guess is he's going to try and give it a go. But we'll see what happens. I'll be really curious to see what happens at shortstop if, in fact, Negro, if, in fact, Marte isn't able to play.
former Salem Red Sox legend Chris Negron, who now goes by Christopher. But yeah, we watched
all
a lot of Chris Negron in 2009.
Dude.
Oh yeah,
I mean,
really,
really great guy. Yeah,
they got too many over.
No,
there.
I still remember a moment in Potomac in 2009. The Red Sox were in town. He was playing. And there was, you know, if you've been to Pfitzner Stadium in Potomac, in Woodbridge, Virginia.
Our condolences.
Yeah, our condolences to you.
PTSD from that place. Wow.
That was one. It's one of the worst field services in the entirety of minor league baseball. And if it rains
that's
there.
That's the best part of the ballpark.
And that's the best part of the ballpark. So if it rains there, like, at 6 a.m. for 10 minutes, the field at 7 p.m. is probably going to be absolute trash. And so I remember we had a big rainstorm in like the middle of the afternoon for a 7 o'clock game. And they were trying to get the field ready It was not happening. But Chris Negron was out there with all of the grounds crew with like brooms, like pushing the water, trying to get it out of the field to play. Like, and this was like maybe 25 minutes before the game was supposed to start. And he was out there just hammering it up with everybody, trying to do all he could to get the game ready to go. And this was in 2009. This is a long time ago. He was that good of a dude then. That could do now. Grady got his chance in the big leagues too. I love Chris Negron back then.
That's awesome. That's a good story.
Yeah, and you know he actually had a good season a couple of years ago for Cincinnati as a super
utility. Yeah,
and he didn't crack the big league roster here this year. He spent last year in AAA with the Cubs. He's got a pretty good history with clearly with these guys because they were all in Boston with him when he was coming up before he was traded to Cincinnati. And then you know, Jared Porter, who's the assistant general manager here, was the assistant general manager at the Cubs or one of it was the director of pro scouting with the Cubs. So they certainly have really good makeup reports on DeGrone. And he's a well-liked player within the front office and within the organization. Total pro.
Well, you know, I mean, some organizations with the connections, familial ties, you get guys like Christopher Negron. Others can't be so lucky as to have Alexi Amarista on their roster for all 162 games. You know, it's just we feel the jealousy from
What's
all around Major League Baseball.
Little ninja.
The little ninja.
The little ninja.
He's, you know, I like the nickname. I'm less high on like the combined like 400 OPS from June through August. Other than that, though. You know,
but he's not on the roster.
But he's so little. Yeah, true. Yeah. You know,
he's got surprising
wheels.
Power for a guy that
he does bad. Actually have a little bit of pop, which is pretty fun. That I will say. But you know, it's whatever. Hopefully, it doesn't factor. If the Rockies are in a circumstance on Wednesday where Alexi Amarista is playing a big role, God, something went horribly wrong. But being the eternal optimist that we are, I have zero doubt that Wednesday's game will end with Daniel Descalso hitting a walk-off homer to get a win for Jorge De La Rosa. So I have absolutely zero doubt that that's the way this is going to go.
I got from your lips to God's ears on that one. That would be awfully nice. I'll tell you it any way we can get it. I mean, listen, I don't want to disparage the Rockies at all because I think it's a really good team with a really bright future. But I do feel like the standings bear it out. The D-backs have been the better team over the course of the season. And I would really like to see them advance the division series because I would like to see how they match up with LA in a five-game playoff.
It's going to be fun. Both matchups are going to be fun. Whoever gets through this.
I want to see them go far for Mike Farron's Q rating nationally to get even higher than it already
same,
is.
We
don't,
so.
Well,
same.
One, it's zero as of now. And two, nobody wants that.
He lowers himself to come on this
least
podcast with frightening regularity.
Yeah, least of all me, so.
He is Mike Farron. You hear him on MLB Network Radio. You hear him pre and post for the Arizona Diamondbacks. And coming up on Wednesday, he'll be there when the Rockies and D-backs clash in Game 1 of the National League postseason in 2017. Mike, we cannot thank you enough, as always, man. And, you know, hopefully we're talking sooner rather than later because the offseason is always way too long, but at least it's shorter this year than other years for both of us.
Yes, that is true. It's always a pleasure to be with you, and I will not speak to either of you on Wednesday.
Deal.
Get yourself a deal, man. Thanks, Mike.
No problem, guys.
Big thanks to Mike Farron for joining the show. You can find him on Twitter. He is at Mike_Farron. I deliberately solicited Ask PDP questions yesterday, but we've gone super long in this episode today. We're just going to go through them rapid fire so far this season. Number one, from at Jared Frawley, quote, do the Rockies have a chance to contend for the division in 2018?
Sure. I mean, there's no reason why they shouldn't. The young guys taking next step, the pitchers, see who they get for to replace Cargo, or if it's just September 2017 Cargo again. We'll see how that shakes out in the offseason. But yeah, David Dahl, it'll be an even season, an even season. So he should be healthy and productive. The odd seasons are always lost for him with injury.
Right.
So yeah, I think of course they can.
He'll probably be an MVP next year.
I think so. That's how it works.
National League MVP.
Yeah.
From our good buddy Matt Hansen, quote, what's the most satisfying way the Rockies can walk off the Dodgers in Game 3 or Game 4 at Coors Field to win the NLDS?
Ian Desmond, walk-off homer.
Absolutely. 1A, Alexi Amarista walk-off homer.
Sure.
From our good buddy Will at Will_E_777, quote, where does Charlie's 2017 rank as the best offensive season by a leadoff batter in MLB history? By the numbers, it ranks as the best.
I think
there is a Coors
one.
Component,
yeah. Yeah.
But the numbers are ridiculous for him.
Yeah, I mean, of course it is. The benchmarks that you hit with knocking off all those different categories, the 200 hits, the 30 doubles, the 14 triples, the 35 homers, 100 ribbies, the 1,000 OPS, the .330 average, batting title. He also stole 14 bases. Yeah, I think it's got to be one of the best leadoff seasons in history, and in my opinion, probably number one.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good.
Now, should it have been a leadoff season all year? Probably not. Maybe should have put down the order second or third or something like that. But, hey, that's an argument for another day.
From Nathan Lee at NLee822, quote, is naming my new dog Donger wildly irresponsible or just the strongest dog name ever? I say maybe it's the greatest dog name in history.
Yeah, it depends on your company. If you're rolling around calling somebody Donger, it really just depends. But in my opinion, I think it's fantastic.
Okay, good. From Adam Busek, this is kind of a throwback. This is from earlier in the month. Quote, what kind of popcorn is best, cheddar, kettle, caramel, or buttered?
Get the hell out of here with kettle corn.
Yeah, kettle corn sucks, man. Kettle corn is among the most overrated things on the planet.
It's in the middle of being like sweet and savory, and it sucks every time. There's never been a good batch of kettle corn ever made in history.
No, I agree. You know what else I think is overrated, and I think I'm going to stand and die alone on this hill? I think funnel cake is overrated.
Yeah, I'm not a funnel cake.
Okay,
guy.
Okay, yeah. Good. We're in agreement. I go cheddar, by the way, with that group.
Cheddar for sure.
Hell yeah. Final one, we'll wrap it up with this, from our good buddy Kyle at Bishop KM. Quote, who's your favorite Twitter follower? Well, guess what? It's you.
Yeah.
And maybe not necessarily you, Kyle. It just means all of you. Guess what?
I agree.
It's you.
I agree.
Oh, my God. This has been so much fun. A playoff edition of the Purple Dinosaur Podcast for the first time in recorded history. And hopefully we got you guys psyched for Wednesday.
You guys get a damn 2-hour podcast. So
I'm psyched for Wednesday.
Hey, and we'll have at least one more to either wrap up the season
or preview the
playoff preview.
The National League Division Series against the Los Angeles Dodgers, which could be in the offing by the end of this week. Holy cow, that is fun.
Really, really hilarious.
All right.
But
I guess
the worst part about this whole thing is I get the legitimate first test of my marriage.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. And actually, I was talking about this
after we got married.
I was talking about this with Manny Radawa, who is one of the MLB.com writers for the Rockies. And Manny and I were discussing yesterday what the bet was going to be, because you guys bet tacos over the regular season series, breakfast tacos. Just breakfast, not necessarily breakfast
not
tacos.
Not necessarily breakfast okay. tacos, but breakfast.
Well, what is it going to be now?
That's a great question. We're not even sure if we're going to be watching it together or what, like – you know, I'm not sure. We have two TVs in the house. I can be upstairs. She can be downstairs, or flip vice versa. I'm not sure. We haven't talked about it at length. We're not sure if we want to be in the same room together.
You have those three little stairs. Yeah, upstairs. You have an apartment.
Upstairs. Okay. Yeah.
It's okay. I get it.
But yeah, well, we're gonna see how my wedding goes after Wednesday. We'll see.
Okay. All right. Well, Godspeed to you.
Thanks,
and that'll do it for us. He's Anthony Masterson. I'm Tyler Mon. Hopefully we'll be previewing the NLDS by the end of this week.
Woo.
Rockies, D-backs, coming up Wednesday. Thanks for tuning in to the first ever playoff edition of the PDP. Love you. Bye.
Bye. I'm 12 kinds of tired.
Yeah, I bet. 12 kinds?
12 kinds of tired.
Huh. What are all those kinds?
Dopey, sneezy, sleepy.
Bashful. Oh, man.